Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this edition of Vatican Weekend. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you the story of Prisca and Aquila, a married couple from our family tree of faith, sharing with you the quotes of Pius XII relating to Shakespeare, bringing you the words of Pope Francis at his weekly general audience this past Wednesday. But first, I'd like to shine the spotlight on Pope Francis and his visit to the Greek island of Lesbos on Saturday. A six-hour journey during which Francis brought back with him to Rome three Syrian families and their six children. Stay tuned. Pope Francis, on Saturday 16th of April, travelled to the Greek island of Lesbos. On his way there, he described this visit as one marked by sadness.
Questo è un viaggio segnato dalla tristezza.
He was speaking to the some 50 journalists and media operators accompanying him on the papal plane, and pointed out that generally, during apostolic visits, there is a joy of encounter. While this visit, he insisted, is different. We are going to meet the worst humanitarian catastrophe since the Second World War.
La catastrofe umanitaria più grande dopo la Seconda Guerra Mondiale.
He then added, we will see many people who are suffering, who do not know where to go, who have had to flee. And then he highlighted how he will be visiting a cemetery, that of the sea.
Andremo anche a un cimitero, il mare.
To the journalists on board, he said many people have drowned. What I'd like to do now to bring you full coverage of this day of the Pope on the island of Lesbos is bring you a couple of reports. The first is from Philippa Hitchin, who tells us all about the mourning there.
You are not alone. That was Pope Francis's message to migrants and refugees on the Greek island of Lesbos, where up to 500,000 asylum seekers have arrived over the past year and a half. His brief visit to the island alongside Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew and the Orthodox Archbishop of Athens, Hieronymus, aimed to draw international attention to the plight of all those fleeing across the Mediterranean Sea to escape conflict and persecution in their home countries. As he did during his first pastoral journey to the Italian island of Lampedusa in 2013, the Pope was able to see and hear that suffering firsthand, in the eyes of women unable to contain tears as they told of losing husbands to the wars in Syria and Iraq, in the voices of men weeping openly as they pleaded for him to do something to ensure security for them and their families, in the drawings which children handed to the Pope on crumpled pieces of paper, depicting themselves behind barbed wire fences or in boats making the perilous journey on which many of their friends have drowned. The Pope and the two Orthodox leaders spent almost an hour walking around the Moria camp, set up to welcome refugees, but since last month's agreement between the EU and Ankara, transformed into a detention centre, where people wait anxiously to learn whether they'll be sent back to Turkey or allowed to join family and friends in other European countries. The religious leaders held hands, listened to the stories, gave a blessing, and promised to do whatever they can.
Siamo venuti per richiamare l'attenzione.
Speaking after these visibly moving encounters, Pope Francis said we all know how easy it is to ignore other people's suffering and even to exploit their vulnerability. But he also praised the solidarity of the Greek people who responded generously to the crisis amid their own economic difficulties. Lesbos alone is currently home to almost 90,000 refugees, more than its original population before the crisis began. Do not lose hope, the Pope said,
non perdete la speranza,
urging world leaders to heed these scenes of desperate need and respond in a way worthy of our common humanity. His words were echoed by those of Archbishop Hieronymus and Patriarch Bartholomew, who said the world will be judged by the way it treats these refugees. The Patriarch highlighted especially the plight of Christians and other minorities in the Middle East region who need urgent action to guarantee their survival.
We promise that we shall never forget you. We shall never stop speaking for you. And we assure you that we will do everything to open the eyes and hearts of the world.
It was the image of a little Syrian boy's body washed up on a Turkish beach last year that did open eyes and hearts to the unfolding tragedy, causing thousands of volunteers to offer all kinds of support to migrants and refugees. The Pope, the Patriarch and the Archbishop will be hoping that the images of their short but symbolic visit to Lesbos will open hearts and minds of political leaders too, to look beyond their short-term interests and find lasting solutions to guarantee the safety and dignity of so many suffering families.
Now we've listened to Philippa Hitchin, let's join Linda Bordoni, who this time tells us about the Pope's afternoon.
Pope Francis has offered a concrete and powerful gesture of solidarity to refugees and prayers to the victims of migration before wrapping up his visit to the Greek island of Lesbos. The decision to offer shelter and care to refugee families who travelled back to Rome with him aboard the papal plane was announced at the end of an intense journey to the island. A six-hour visit marked by many poignant and moving moments included prayers and a tribute to those who have drowned during a ceremony at the Lesbos port of Mytilene. According to the International Organization for Migration, 366 people have died crossing the water from Turkey to Greece since the beginning of this year alone. There are many children and infants amongst the victims. And after having shared the midday meal with a dozen of them of different provenance, the Pope and the leaders of the world's Orthodox Christians and the Church of Greece travelled to the main port in Lesbos and paid tribute to those who have drowned at sea. The three led a minute of silence in front of a crowd of hundreds of people at the port before tossing yellow and white floral wreaths into the waters. Then Francis, Patriarch Bartholomew and Archbishop Hieronymus prayed for all those who have died after leaving their homelands in search of protection and a better life. Though many of their graves bear no name, Francis prayed the Lord, to you each one is known, loved and cherished.
Da te ognuno è conosciuto, amato e prediletto.
And invoking God's tender closeness, he said, we seek a world where none are forced to leave their home and where all can live in freedom, dignity and peace. Francis's prayer also called for an awakening from the slumber of indifference.
Destaci dal sonno dell'indifferenza.
And for the opening of our eyes to the suffering of so many. Inspire us as nations, communities and individuals, he prayed, to see that those who come to our shores are our brothers and sisters, that we may recognize that together, as one human family, we are all migrants journeying in hope to you, our true home.
Che sei la nostra vera casa.
The brief but intense visit concluded with a powerful gesture and example of solidarity for the eyes of an indifferent world. Three refugee families from Syria, including six children, boarded the plane with Francis, destination Rome. The Vatican says it will support them financially and they will be cared for by the St. Egidio community, which has worked out a program with the Italian government to grant refugees humanitarian visas to live in Italy while their asylum applications are being processed. I'm Linda Bordoni.
In a related story, earlier in the week, Linda Bordoni spoke to the Jesuit Refugee Services Policy and Advocacy Director for Europe. He's Mark Provera. Be sure to listen on.
I think the Pope's visit is a wonderful sign of solidarity. It's an indication, a continuation of his efforts with forced migrants all the way from the beginning of his papacy up until recent times and his statements on maintaining the dignity of forced migrants.
Following the recent agreement between the EU and Turkey, what is the situation refugees and migrants arriving in Greece on Lesbos Island? What kind of situation do they find themselves in?
Jairus, Europe is in contact with our office in Athens, and we can say that we see many forced migrants in a very vulnerable position. The recent agreement between Brussels and Ankara is an extremely unjust one. This is not about protection. It's about deterrence. And it consists of really two core elements, and that is that forced migrants seeking protection, fleeing violence in their own country, when they reach the Greek islands, quickly assessed, and then with a view to having them returned back to Turkey. The second aspect is that for every Syrian returned to Turkey from Greece, another completely different Syrian will be admitted to an EU member state, which has been called the one-for-one deal. Now, the one-for-one scheme is perverse in that it still relies on one Syrian risking their life and making the journey from Turkey to Greece in order for another completely different Syrian to be resettled in the EU. So claims that this scheme saves lives ring hollow, given that it's based on forced migrants actually engaging in the very risk that this deal purports to avoid.
It sounds like it's in absolute violation of international humanitarian law.
I think there's a very strong chance that it is. It is an absolute turning point in the way that states deal with people seeking protection. It is contrary to international law on the non-refoulement of refugees seeking protection, and I think that once we're getting to the stage of having to unpick international EU and European law, if we keep going down this route, how do we really expect to justly regulate our relations with one another?
Notwithstanding, I assume that most of these forced refugees, forced migrants, know about the agreement. They are still arriving on the island, which says a lot about where they're coming from, right?
That's correct, Linda. I think that what it is a clear sign that the protection needs of forced migrants are incredibly great, and that even this scheme, even though it should not deter people, cannot deter people from seeking protection from violence and conflict that they experience in their home countries. To me, to JRS Europe, it's a clear indication that forced migrants maintain hope of finding protection, of finding safety, and also to seek community.
I would think that the last thing they would expect is to be hoarded into some kind of detention centre, which is what I understand is happening at the moment at the big Moria centre, which has become completely militarised. Do you know what the situation there is?
We understand that formerly open centres which have been called hotspots in European policy language, have now been transformed into detention centres. This is particularly troubling because we see detention as a very much a last resort, but more so because of the profile of forced migrants who are reaching the Greek islands. The statistics show a large number of adults with their families, a high proportion of women and children, and in these circumstances, with this profile, this is entirely inappropriate reception conditions for people to be held in and to be detained in. It is no way to treat vulnerable people who are seeking protection.
Mark, what would JRS like to see, what new policies or new laws, regulations would JRS like to see implemented at this point?
Well, Linda, European governments need to rethink not only the legality of this deal, but they need to commit to honouring their international and their moral obligations to protect some of the most vulnerable people in the world. We would like to see, firstly, that all asylum seekers arriving on EU territory have full and proper access to the asylum procedure and that their claims are assessed properly in accordance with international and European law. The second thing is that we have been saying for a number of years now that we need to use a full complement of ways to ensure that people can reach European territory safely in order to make their claim for asylum. For example, that a greater use of resettlement and humanitarian admission, a greater use of family reunification instruments, the use of humanitarian visas, and allowing people to obtain visas to arrive on EU territory, and finally to consider the prospect of private sponsorship.
So the current laws need to be at least upgraded, if not changed, right?
In some circumstances, yes, but in other circumstances, there are already existing instruments which could be used and which member states are at liberty to implement themselves. So there is, in some cases, little impediment for member states to move forward with some of these actions. We have already seen the great work of the community of Sant'Egidio in promoting the use of humanitarian visas with Italy and with great success. So we hope to see more European governments take this sort of comprehensive approach to using the full range of possibilities for people to seek protection in the European Union.
Mark, you were saying that JRS welcomes Pope Francis's visit. What kind of an impact do you hope it may have, apart, of course, from highlighting the plight of these people?
I think, Linda, that what we see from JRS Europe's perspective is that the focus needs to be on the human person, and the Pope's visit very much highlights that. By bartering people as mere numbers, we forget that there are individual people involved in very perilous and vulnerable situations. We forget that why people are leaving protection and why they are leaving their countries in order to seek protection in Europe. So we hope that the Pope's visit will highlight very much the personal circumstances and that people find themselves in.
Earlier in the week, as always on Wednesdays, Pope Francis held his weekly general audience with pilgrims in St. Peter's Square. Anne Schneiber reports.
During his catechesis, Pope Francis centered his reflection on the gospel account of Jesus calling St. Matthew to be his disciple. Like the tax collector Matthew, every one of us relies on the Lord's grace despite our sins, the Pope said. The Church is not a community of the perfect, but of disciples on their way who follow the Lord because they recognize they are sinners and need forgiveness. Jesus is the good doctor, and there is no sickness he cannot cure. Pope Francis spoke of the importance of the Eucharist as a powerful remedy which renews the grace of our baptism. The Pope said the Pharisees did not understand God's heart, for they did not recognize the possibility of reformation and healing, trusting in the law over mercy. It was as though someone gave you a box with a gift inside, and you, rather than looking for the gift, only looked at the paper in which it was wrapped, only the appearances, the form, but not the grace at the core, the gift which is given to everyone. I'm Anne Schneibel.
Now, stepping back in time on a totally different note, I'd like to tell you a story, that of a flesh and blood married couple who can claim our family tree of faith. The story is told for us by our scripture scholar, Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia, Mark Benedict Coleridge.
Great friends of St. Paul, and like him, they were Jewish Christians. They're usually remembered by the names Prisca and Aquila, even though at times she is called Priscilla. But usually it's Prisca and Aquila. Now, these are very, very Roman names. But in fact, both of them came from Pontus, as it was called, in what is modern-day northeastern Turkey, up near the Black Sea. Like so many, they found their way from the provinces to the capital, and once in Rome, they became Christian. So they were Jewish Christians, as well established in the community in Rome. In fact, they're the first names we know of the Roman Church. Now, like Paul, they were also tent makers. This was their trade. And they seemed to have flourished because they must have had money. How do we know they had money? First of all, they had a big house. And the poor lived in tiny little apartments then as now. They had a big house, possibly on the Aventine Hill, which was a very, very plush part of town then, as it is now. We also know that they were Roman citizens, and you needed money to become a Roman citizen. Now, in the year 49, there was among Jews in Rome, and in fact probably among Jews and Christians in Rome, a dispute that became violent. Now, we're told in the Roman sources it was a dispute about a figure called Crestus, probably Christ. As a result, the Emperor Claudius said, "Now look, out of the city." So he expelled Jewish leaders and Jewish Christian leaders from the city, and among those certainly were Prisca and Aquila. So expelled from Rome, they end up in Corinth, and there they meet Paul in one of those fateful meetings of Christian history. In fact, Paul comes to live with them and sets up, therefore, one of the great ménage à trois of Christian history. One can only imagine a household containing Prisca, Aquila and Paul. They ply their common trade, making tents for Corinth, but more importantly, they preach the gospel in Corinth, and there they do it with power. But it's a mission that costs plenty, and it costs Prisca and Aquila almost their life, because Paul tells us in the letter to the Romans that they risked their lives for his sake. They go with him on mission from Corinth to Ephesus. So they become travelling missionaries, the married couple. No mention of children, by the way. So they go to Ephesus and there they stay on a preaching mission as Paul goes further. Eventually, when Claudius gets over his fit of pique, they return to Rome. And again, they set up a big house, again probably on the Aventine. And we know for a fact that a church, a group of Roman Christians, met in their house for worship. It may well have been in that house that Paul spent the time, the couple of years of his house arrest in Rome. It may also be the site of what is known today as the Church of Santa Prisca on the Aventine Hill. Interestingly, there's a suggestion throughout that Prisca was the more powerful of the two personalities. Not only because the church bears her name, but almost always she's mentioned first. It's never Aquila and Prisca, but Prisca and Aquila. So there's every chance that she was a bit like some of those women in the Old Testament, a more powerful personality than her husband. Tradition has it that they were beheaded outside the walls. It's impossible to know. But one thing is clear, it certainly fits the pattern. It fits the pattern of their life, a life of the travelling apostle, the travelling missionary, which in a sense inevitably led to the witness of martyrdom. But it also fits the pattern of Nero's persecution, because Nero was determined to get rid of the leaders. And that's why Peter and Paul, and I think probably figures like Prisca and Aquila, would have been swept away in the persecution of Nero in the mid-60s. Like all the New Testament characters we've met, they were Jewish, they were Christian, they were missionaries, and I think probably they were martyrs. Flesh and blood people, but flesh and blood who can claim the family tree of faith, the magnificent family tree of faith.
You were listening there to scripture scholar Mark Benedict Coleridge, Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia. Finally, Shakespeare was on the agenda this past week as the Globe Theatre performed Hamlet on Vatican territory, marking the first full performance of Shakespeare in the Vatican. While last week we took a look at Paul VI, the 20th century Pope who was often likened to Hamlet, I'd now like to bring you an example of how an earlier Pope, Pius XII, used to occasionally quote from Shakespeare's works. Stay tuned. To mark the fourth centenary of the death of William Shakespeare, I thought I'd delve into our Vatican Radio archives and find out more about the papacy and Shakespeare. What I discovered are a few quotes on the part of Pius XII, a pope who, it seems, was a bit of a fan of this great Englishman and sometimes peppered his speeches with Shakespearean quotes. Beginning in 1946, while speaking of Mother Cabrini. It was the 9th of July, and while highlighting how her thoughts flew high when it came to doing good, he quoted from her writings when she says, "I feel the world is too small to satisfy my desires." He then added how in reading these words he was reminded of Portia from The Merchant of Venice, who once said, quote, "My little body is aweary of this great world." Unquote. A year later, this time it was the 5th of May, and while speaking to delegates of an international postal congress, Pius XII said, "Any international congress is of particular interest to us. It bespeaks a breaking down of needless barriers and a uniting of nations." And, quoting from Hamlet, he said that it is a consummation devoutly to be wished. Finally, in March 1948, while speaking to students at the American Overseas School of Rome, Pius XII said, "Even the delicate irony of your genial Shakespeare points up to this holy design for a home and classroom when it fits into the woeful pageant of the seven ages of man, played too often on the stage of the world." And he then quoted As You Like It, quote, "The whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face creeping like a snail, unwilling to go to school." That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to find out more about our programming and indeed about the visit of Pope Francis to Lesbos, be sure to check out our website at www.rv.va. And why not like our Facebook page as you go along? You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.